We made this.
Welcome back to You Have Been Watching, a podcast devoted to looking in-depth into the fascinating curiosity that is the British television sitcom, part of the We Made This podcast network. I'm your host, Tony Black, and I'm joined by my co-host, Robert Turnbull, for an episode in which we celebrate the 100th anniversary of the BBC by taking a deep dive into the British sitcom across the decades as produced by the British Broadcasting Corporation. So yeah, Rob, this was something that you suggested a while back, actually, in order to sort of tie into the centenary of the BBC, which is a pretty big deal. You know, there's a lot of programming that's going on. There's a big Doctor Who, you know, as well, that's going to coincide with it, all kinds of things. So it seemed like a good opportunity to sort of talk a bit about the span of sitcom, I guess, across like this last, maybe not quite 100 years, but certainly the duration of the BBC so far in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, near as damn it 100 years. I mean, they've been producing comedy since pretty much the get-go. And as we'll get into, you know, sitcom as we think of it has been a part, on screen, has been a part of almost that 100 years. Mm. So yeah, it seems like a nice opportunity just to chat about, I guess, the importance of the BBC in terms of British sitcom, because it is important, you know. The BBC really has led the way. So yeah, it's a nice opportunity to sort of wax lyrical on that, I think.
Yeah, it's also an episode we haven't done a vast amount of research for because we're lazy. No. So we were like, let's do one where we don't have to watch like tons and tons of stuff, and we could just go.
Yeah,
by
what does BBC stand for?
we're gonna talk about things we've seen, some things we haven't seen, you know, but we're just going to generally sort of go through a lot of the decades, really, overall. But before we do, quick reminder, guys, please follow us on social media, if you haven't already, at YHB Watching Pod on Facebook and Twitter. Come and talk to us about comedy. Come and talk to us about the episodes we're doing. And if you really like the show, please do us a favour. Hop onto iTunes and give us, or Apple Podcasts, as it's called now, and give us a 5-star rating and review. That'd be magic. That'd really help us in a big way. So thanks if you do either of those. Why don't we start, though, Rob, by talking just generally about how we feel about the BBC and our feelings.
Shut it down! No.
All right, Nadine, right? But yeah. But yeah, I mean, we're both obviously British. We're both in our early 40s. The BBC has been around long before we were born. It's been around for our parents and our grandparents' generations. But what does it mean to you, really, generally, as an organisation, Rob?
Yeah, I love the BBC, for starters. I'm a huge, huge fan of the BBC. And I think it is one of those, it's an intrinsically British thing, the concept behind it. Like, there's no other broadcaster in the world that works quite the same way as the BBC in terms of its remit and the programming and what it has to provide for the people. You know, there are a few similar channels and networks out there, but nothing like the BBC. And I think it's a really significant part of our culture. I think it's a really important part of our culture. I do think it's something we should be incredibly proud of and something that we should protect. And I know that there are lots of completely different discussions that this is not the place to have about funding models and all this kind of stuff, which are not relevant, you know, to what we're going to talk about now, except to say that Netflix funding model is fucking stupid, guys, just shut up. But there's a whole, you know, the BBC is incredibly important. It's something that we should be proud of and something that we should protect. I am so pleased to have had it growing up. I'm so pleased to have been as a sort of almost to have been nurtured by the BBC, because I think it's whether this is digressing or not, it's like I grew up listening to radio a lot and listening to Radio 4 rather than just music radio, watching the BBC a lot in terms of the program that it produced. Also, I may have referenced before, I was home educated, And so the educational programs that the BBC provided still does amazing educational content. But growing up as a kid in the 80s, the schools programs that they put on every single day, and the Open University programs that were all part of my sort of educational progress. So it really has been massively integrated in my whole life. Not to mention now as an adult, I have worked for the BBC and worked for production companies that produce stuff for the BBC. So I love it, and it's been there my whole life, you know, in some form or another.
Yeah, I mean, I've never worked for them, obviously, a lot unlike you, but it does feel like it's a really unique British thing in many ways. I don't think any country really has anything quite like the BBC in terms of what it does. And there are all kinds of debates floating around as to its relevance, you know, and paying for the TV license through it in order to not have advertising, and does it fit? And you know, they've done a lot of modernizing over the last few years. They've really tried to change a lot of the ways they do things. You know, they've pivoted a lot to iPlayer. They've brought back things like BBC Three. They've introduced things like BBC Sounds. They're trying to keep current with a lot of the trends to do with podcasting, television, cinema, all this kind of stuff, as best they can, even while fighting a system that is pivoting towards a lot more money than they will ever get and a lot more competition. But I think there is, in terms of brand, it is global, and it stands for something, doesn't it? It stands for something that's a certain kind of programming, I think, really, with the BBC. Whether it's, you know, the various different channels, whether it's one or two or four, or as we said, three, all of which have had different kinds of stylistics to them. I mean, a BBC One, Two and Three sitcom is a very different beast, and it traditionally has been throughout the years. But there's a certain standard, if not always of quality, because not everything they've produced is gold. But I think when we talk about the certainly in terms of comedy, if we talk about the span of comedy across the last 70, 80 years, I would say a good 75, 80% of the best comedy has come out of the BBC, I would argue.
I think it's almost unarguable that that's the case.
Yeah. And so I think it stands for a certain level of production and approach that the other channels just can't really do or have never been able to do. And I think that's why it's so important. You know, 100 years on, it's still really relevant. It's still making some of the best stuff out there. And I think it is really important to our culture. You're spot on. We'd be much less richer without it, I think.
We'd be much worser off.
Worser off.
Yeah. No, but we would, though. It's like, I mean, we've done a dozen or so episodes so far, and I think the majority of the shows we've talked about have been BBC shows, particularly the ones that we have enjoyed the most, whether they're the most high profile or not. And I think that there's a certain, you know, Channel 4, you know, does valiant work in terms of like promoting new talent and new culture through its programming. But the BBC, because of its remit, because of what it has to provide and the audience that it has to cater for, which is basically everybody, it's always prepared to take certain kind of chance on things. And there's something about the BBC that it does nurture talent. You know, you look at I suppose, like the Ben Eltons and the Richard Curtises, you know, these people that, you know, they start off doing, you know, writing sketches on BBC shows, and they get weird little anarchic sitcoms, and then basically they get almost like looked after by the BBC. I mean, I know it's you know, the business is more fickle than that, but there's something about the nurturing of talent that the BBC is able to do because it's free of those kind of like those commercial constraints. It's like ITV could never, ever produce a show like The Mighty Boosh, because it's too much of a risk. Channel 4 maybe could, but they'd still, you know, there's still a lot of factors at play. Also, the BBC has always been a lot more... it's weird because I think we think of BBC One as being sort of like a nice, comfortable, middle-class channel. But there's always been an element of the BBC in producing comedy and sitcom that they're happy to have a slight edginess to it. on a mainstream, I mean, a beautiful example, obviously, is, you know, and we'll get on to decades and shows, I'm sure, in a bit. But, you know, you look at when Men Behaving Badly was on ITV and was a kind of an 8:30 sitcom and kind of plodded along and wasn't great. Got canned. The BBC picked it up, instantly put it, you know, post Watershed, because they could recognise the kind of show that it needed to be, and the whole show kind of elevated. And I think it's the BBC's ability to put things in the right place, like you say about BBC 1, 2 and 3 having very different sitcoms. And of course, some of the shows migrate. If they're very popular in one place, they do shift over. But I think the BBC is uniquely positioned to nurture talent and take chances on talent that the other networks aren't. I mean, it always used to be the case that the BBC commissioned two series of anything. It was always, you know, a series one and a series two, because they know, you know that that's how you build up an audience. And that's how you get things like Blackadder series one shifting into Blackadder series two, because you've already committed to a series two. But if you were waiting to see how series one goes, we never would have, Blackadder wouldn't be a thing.
No. Yeah.
It would be a one-off. If it had been on a commercial channel, they'd have looked at that first series and said, we can't do any more of this. Whereas at the BBC, you know, they can, I don't want to say they can afford to, but from a creative point of view, traditionally speaking, things are a lot tighter these days, but traditionally speaking, they could take that chance. That's why there are two series of Dinner Ladies, even though nobody enjoyed the first series. they'd commissioned two, so yeah. So Victoria were just like, all right then, we're not getting another one after this, let's end it properly. And I think that's a big factor to what helps maintain the quality and also the lasting nature of BBC sitcom.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and they it's that investment in talent as well, isn't it? You know, and that's a good example, Dinner Ladies, in that they knew that Victoria Wood was a national treasure, really, and they put that, even though the show in the end wasn't great necessarily, they put that faith in to do those two series. And then you had in the end something that, like you say, she was able to wrap up. So it is having that element to it that some of the other channels didn't have, you know, and it's unique in terms of the BBC. I think it's completely unique. So let's go back then. Let's spool back and talk decade by decade. Need to find the right sound effect there, didn't I? And go back to the beginning in a way. Like you said, they've been producing comedy on radio throughout, you know, from the 1920s into the 1930s, 40s, etc., during the war. Do you know what the first televised sitcom was, though, on the BBC?
During the war? I do, because I did some research before today.
Same. But no, that was the one bit of research I did do, yeah.
Do the audience at home know?
Yeah, well. What's your answer, Rob? Let's see if we both come on to the same thing.
I've forgotten what it's called. Pennyworth's Progress. No.
Pinwright's.
Pennyworth's Progress.
Pinwright's. Pinwright's, yes. Progress.
Pinwright's Progress. Yes. James Hayter.
Yes. Yeah. Starring James Hayter, yeah. It's Pinwright's Progress, which aired on the BBC from 1946 to 1947. Starred James Hayter, who is probably quite, well, known for quite a few things, but he particularly cropped up in a series or two of I Been Served years later. But yeah, he's known for quite a lot of different things, both serious and comedic. And it was 10 episodes. It was the world's first regular half-hour televised sitcom, Pinwright's Progress.
Yes, amazing.
Yeah, broadcast live from BBC Studios at Alexandra Palace. Sadly, because they would erase tapes and things were broadcast in a certain way, that none of it survives except still photographs. So that's the case with so many BBC productions for the first few decades when television is properly kicking in. But the fact that we had a TV sitcom in the late 1940s on the BBC is quite remarkable, really. And I mean, in this case, the story is that Jay Pinwright, played by James Hayter, is the proprietor of a little shop. He has a rival, and the staff are trying to help him, and that causes comedy. And the messenger boy called Ralph is apparently a deaf octogenarian. So it has basic root elements of comedy, doesn't it? It almost sounds like a proto.
It sounds great.
It sounds like a proto Open All Hours.
It sounds a bit dark, right? Doesn't it?
It really does. Yeah. But the fact that this was in the 40s, right at the end of the Second World War, I mean, that's remarkable, isn't it? That they had a sitcom that far back.
Oh, it's incredible. Yeah. Like I said, I'm not going to pretend that this was knowledge that I had at my fingertips.
Same.
I was looking into this. I think I had come across this title before in various kind of like readings and researches of just being interested in sitcom. I don't think I had ever realised that it was the first. Or that it was the first in the world. This sounds glib. I always assumed that the UK had the first TV sitcom because we more or less had the first TV. Like the BBC is like pretty much, you know, Mark Dot for television. You know, it's so, you know, early on. So I wasn't surprised to see that it was the very first one, but I hadn't realised that it was the first UK one, but it sounds quite good.
It does sound quite good. I, in a way, though, I am a bit surprised that it's the world's first, because American networks were starting to kick off around this point into the 50s, and you had American sitcoms like I Love Lucy, you know, in the 50s, all really taking off. So I, in a way, I am a bit surprised, much as it's the BBC, that we got the first ever one broadcast.
Well, you see, I think that British television, and this does come down to the BBC, there's always been something a bit more grassroots, a bit more kind of like relatable to people and drama. I think American TV, even now, but especially back then, was still stuck in that kind of the big band process. You know, because the BBC, a lot of the early programming, you know, there were some live dramas, and then there were basically kind of like big band shows where patter comedians would come on and someone would do some singing and some dancing. And I think that American TV was still quite focused on that.
Yeah.
And for us in the UK, I think almost as soon as television started, we wanted to see depressing real working class people. It was like almost instantly we're like, this dancing's very nice, but yeah, can we see some people suffering like us? And I think there's something about sitcom is that it a lot of the best sitcoms are about ordinary people, you know, just trying to get on with life. And, you know, without seeing an episode of it, this sounds like that. It's sort of, you know, maybe a slightly pompous upper working lower middle class shop owner just trying to get through life. It definitely sounds like there's some Basil Fawlty quality there with his, you know, aging assistant and all this kind of stuff. Definitely, like we say, proto Arkwright. So I think there's something very British about the concept of this sitcom. So I'm not surprised that we started producing this kind of stuff so early on, because I think it's always been in our DNA to see a little bit of comedy suffering.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, 100%. Yeah, it feels like it's something that is very much part of the British style of self-deprecation. And I suppose, you know, it fits that post-war period as well, doesn't it? Because, you know, you're in a period of austerity. You've got a change in government now in the Attlees coming in and bringing in the NHS, and there's a social, you know, democratic change going on in the UK. But, you know, rationing still goes on for years afterwards, like a good decade or more afterwards. It's before the period of boom, you know, in the UK. Americans have got it a little bit better because the 50s is a bit of a boom period for them in a different kind of way. And they're getting, you know, more televisions and more home equipment and things like that. But it feels like the 50s has to be, you know, it's that black and white, very funny, but it has that reflective dourness of a country that's still going
yes.
through that post-war thing. And then you get into the 50s and the big next one is still one of the greats today, Hancock's Half Hour.
Exactly.
Which kicks in after being a radio show in 1954 on the BBC, kicks in 56 and then runs to 61, after which Hancock goes to ITV, and it never seems to be apparently quite the same.
Never. As soon as they go to ITV, it's never the same, is it?
No. And we know generally, yeah. And we talked a bit about Hancock before, didn't we? A couple of times, but and we will eventually do an episode on Hancock, and it will be great to go back and try and watch as many of them that still exist, because quite a few of them, I think, were wiped as well back in the day.
Yeah, a lot were lost.
But like Tony Hancock was, I mean, it's the seminal BBC sitcom, really, isn't it? It's sort of the Rosetta Stone. If Pym writes Progress is like the first attempt at stuff that will be better executed later, and I know we haven't seen the show, but I'd imagine it wasn't as razor sharp as stuff to come, then Hancock's Half Hour is the first show to really tap into that, the down on his luck British miser character that has just carried
the
through.
The dour misery, yeah.
And I think it really did set the tone there, didn't it, for so many things to come.
It did. And I think that, you know, we're talking about, you know, the self-deprecating humour that we enjoy so much as a British people. And I think that, again, the BBC, if you look at BBC sitcoms, so many of them have this kind of like this working class, or at very least middle, you know, lower middle class. This kind of, you know, we look at Porridge and you know, I guess even looking at something like, you know, 2.4 Children, it's all very relatable comedy. And I think that some of the other channels across the years, maybe because of the you know, the desire to attract commercial backers, maybe their sitcoms haven't been as miserable. Maybe they've been a little bit jollier, a little bit more lighthearted. They haven't tried to be as culturally educational, because they don't want to put people off. Whereas the BBC are quite happy to produce something that might put people off.
Yeah. I think so. And that's interesting in itself, isn't it? Because a lot of, you know, BBC would have been ran by quite, you know, middle, at very least middle class white men, you know, so the fact that they, you know, that they, and probably upper class white men, you know, in many cases. So the fact that they were willing to commission a lot of these working class, you know, sitcoms and comedies and things like that is interesting. I think it's that it's almost like they are, maybe it's part of that changing social movement within the UK.
Well,
know, that's happening.
I think there are a couple of things at play. It's like, one is that I think that the BBC always was run by people who, perhaps this is, I'm being over generous, but I feel like it was run by people who understood that they didn't understand.
Yeah.
So like, you can be a stuffy middle-aged man and you can go, right, okay, so I don't understand these young people and their comedy, so I don't want to commission it. But you get someone who goes, well, I don't understand it, but the young people like it, so let's get a series. And I think that's been the case. I mean, a lot of these, you know, creatives, they talk about having their meetings with the BBC, and that was almost the conversation. It was like, I mean, the most famous one, obviously it's radio, but it was like when The Goon Show was commissioned and the commissioners sat in the room and they were like, well, this is a bit racy, The Go On Show. And it had to be explained to them that it was Goon and it was, you know, goofy title. But I think another big factor, apart from the fact that they've always been prepared to take a risk and the stuffy middle-class men in charge were still happy to take a risk on working class, there are a couple of things that I think have played in the favour of the BBC. One is radio, because you cannot understate how many of the best sitcoms started out as radio. And I could list dozens and dozens of them right now, but I think it might be quite fun to have an episode about later on. But that's like a stomping ground. It's like a testing ground. It's like, if you think about, you know, I mean, you personally or people listening at home, if you write down your five favourite sitcoms of the last, you know, 20 years or whatever, I guarantee you at least one of them is going to have been a transfer from radio. And that's a unique position that the BBC has, unlike anyone else in the world. There is no other broadcaster which basically gets to test its on-screen programming in such a cheap and risk-free format. You know, you can make 2-3 series of The Mighty Boosh on radio, and it costs you, you know, two actors in a recording studio with an audience. It's like, it's so cheap to produce. And then you say, right, people love this, let's make a TV show of it. And also, the scripts are half written.
Yeah.
It's a unique position that the BBC has that no one else has. And I think that allows them to have taken what might appear to have been risks in terms of bringing shows to the TV screen. But they're not risk. They're slightly less risky because it's tried and tested. They've already checked it. But also, the BBC very early got into this concept of pilots, but broadcast pilots. You know, we know about American pilots this season. But the BBC, you know, it's stuff like Steptoe and Son. That was part of a series of one-off comedy plays almost. And they see which one works and they go, right, that one works. Let's make a series of it. So I think the broadcast pilot as series is something that the BBC were very good in kind of like pioneering as well.
Yeah, so they've already like putting in place, you know, test runs, I guess, of concepts and things like this, which is, you know, and then it's leading to some great returns in ultimately, isn't it? And I think it's interesting because you've got, in the 50s, you've got these kind of radio crossover shows like Hancock, and another big one in the 50s was called Wacko, which starred Jimmy Edwards, who was a popular comedian at the time.
Love Jimmy Edwards.
Yeah. Written by Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, who went on to write, you know, so many great things. Dennis Norden, obviously.
Well, everything.
Yeah. Dennis Norden, famous for The Clipboard and It'll Be All Right on the Night years later, which is what I remember him for growing up. The Clipboard that had nothing on it, as far as I could tell. But I mean, I didn't, you know what I found out recently? You might know this already, but the greatest line in any Carry On film ever came from them originally. So if you remember Carry On Cleo, which is one of the best Carry On movies, I would say, the great line spoken by Kenneth Williams Caesar, which you know it, which is infamy, they've all got it infamy, which I think is one of the greatest comedy lines ever written. That was
utter fucking genius.
Brilliant. That was borrowed by Talbot Rothwell, who wrote the script, but from Frank Muir and Dennis Norden. I didn't know that until recently. But so those two are great. Just wanted to get that in there because I love that fact, because it's an amazing line. And this was a school set comedy. So that again, it's about a drunken gambling headmaster, basically, who runs a public school in a vein of tyranny and things like that. Again, I haven't seen this one, but this ran throughout the 60s and was very popular. Ran for the 50s and was very popular into the 60s. But it sort of leads into that, I suppose, a bit of a balance within the 60s between comedies that are very, very working class and sort of shine a light on a lot of the social issues that are going on in the 60s, and others that might lean a bit more towards the middle class and the upper class with a certain level of, and I think you see more of this maybe in the 70s, but with a little bit more of a spoofery about it. Whereas in the 60s, it feels like you've got a lot of stuff that is geared towards a very, very working class mindset. You've got stuff like The Rag Trade, for instance, which is a big, you know, a big show, which is about a clothing workshop, a textile workshop. You've got stuff like The Liverbirds, which is Carla Lane's first show set in Liverpool. You know, so, you know, you would never have had two Liverpool housewives who meet, and it's all about those two. And it's very, you know, it's very grounded in that sense. You've got The Likely Lads, which is set in the Northeast, you know, and he's James Bolan, Rodney Bewes, famous show about two mates, two working class men, and in their 20s. And then Till Death Us Do Part, which is probably the most famous in terms of the character it spawns, Warren Mitchell's Alf Garnett. And obviously he's getting into all of the social issues, bigotry, racism, homophobia. Mm-hmm. And it has a bit of a mixed legacy, Till Death Us Do Part. But I suppose what I'm saying, Rob, is that the BBC then starts to tread into areas where, if the 50s was establishing some of the comic templates and the down on their luck, or maybe balanced with a little bit of anarchy, you know, at times in terms of that comedy, the 60s really brings in the social element, I'd say, and does a lot more with working class
definitely
communities around the country as well.
Definitely. I think there's and this is the thing about the BBC needing and wanting to appeal to its audience and being very aware of the fact that a huge part of the audience are a more sort of like working class, maybe down at luck. It's like Till Death Us Do Part. It's like it's a fascinating, we will do an episode, I'm sure.
Definitely.
A fascinating example of this as something which is starting to challenge, but is also maybe restricted by the writer's concepts, but is very relatable and very real. The Liverbirds, fantastic. You know, I have mixed feelings about Carla Lane. And the Liverbirds ran for a long time and there's, you know, mixed quality there. But it's the idea, even 10 years earlier, the idea of a sitcom about a couple of young Liverpudlian, you know, girls hanging out and, you know, it's you wouldn't have dreamed of it. And I'm not sure that the commercial channels would have necessarily been ready to take a chance on that. I'm not saying that they can't or they didn't, but I'm not sure they'd have been ready to like jump in with something like that. They, you know, ITV were still very happy to, you know, put Sid James in a situation with a wife and kids and, you know, leave it at that.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's got some, it does have some really interesting things that they're doing in this decade. I mean, I suppose the question is, well, I think a lot of people have sort of suggested the 70s is probably the golden age of sitcom. But I think there's a little bit of that in the 60s as well. I don't know if it has quite the strength of the 70s in terms of some of the iconic creations and some of the iconic characters. But then it does have stuff like Steptoe and Son, you know, which
it does. Well, you know,
is a great show.
I think part of the...
Dad's Army, starts in the 60s. So, you know.
Well, that's the word there, starts. And this is the thing, you know, when we talk about decades, we talk about them very precisely, 60s, 70s. The reality is that any kind of like identity that a decade has usually, in fact, carries across from one decade to the other. So when you think about what is exclusively 50s, you're actually talking mid 50s to early 60s.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when we talk about the 60s, we're talking about mid 60s to early 70s and so on and so on. So it definitely feels like the 70s is the golden age. But the reality is that a lot of the shows that we're talking about started in the 60s, had their birth in the 60s. Obviously, something like The Likely Lads basically starts in the 60s and then you get what is more or less a sequel to it in the 70s. Steptoe and Son starts in the 60s, goes off air for a few years and then comes back and really kind of like kicks in the 70s. So I think that it's a tricky one. It's like, yes, you can look at the 70s and say that was kind of like the golden age of sitcom. And you do have things like Fawlty Towers and you know, stuff like that, which really cements itself as the 60s. But as the 70s. But I think that the 60s, it's very valid. I think that it's almost like the 60s into the 70s. That's the golden decade. There's a sort of a good 10-year period that sets up the golden period. And I think it really is that moment mid-60s where things kind of go, okay, we've got some women's lib, we want to talk about social issues, we want to introduce some minorities into our comedy without making fun of them, and we want to really relate to and reflect the kind of the working class and all aspects of like class in the country. I think that sort of triggers in the 60s, and I think it carries through comfortably into the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, Dad's Army is a perfect example. You know, there's no sense of, you know, it's not the Liverbirds, it's not the Likely Lads, it's not Till Death Us Do Part. But in terms of being an incredibly strong sitcom that appealed to people, kicks off in the 60s, goes right through into the 70s. So yeah, I think there's a golden period that rides those two decades.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you're right there about the crossover element. And I think partly as well, it's that you've got actors actually starting to play comic parts as well, as opposed to just comedians, as opposed to people who came up.
Well, exactly, yes.
You know,
yeah.
You've got actual people who were previously like serious-minded actors, you know, and some of whom maybe wrestle a little bit with being pigeonholed. Oh, I mean, yeah. I think people like Harry H. Corbett struggled with just being known as Steptoe, you know, and that those kind of people. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, Harry H. Corbett, there's almost a tragedy to his career. But it's interesting because I think that a huge part of what made Steptoe such a success in terms of that pilot, I don't know if you've watched, I'm sure you've watched the pilot episode.
Years ago.
It's barely a sitcom. It's very funny. But the last 10 minutes are basically Harry H. Corbett just acting his heart out. And you're like, Jesus, this is depressing. I'd like to see this every week. But of course he did, you know, that brilliant Harry H. Corbett voice, which is, he doesn't sound anything like that. But then when he's in other films, he turns up and he tries to act. And he's like, oh, hello, it's me, it's Harry. Yeah. I'm going to do this. No, do the voice. And so people think of Harry H. Corbett as having that voice. And I think there is a tragedy to him being pigeonholed by that. Sorry, I'm digressing,
No,
you're right.
You're
right, though, about real actors. It's like the same with Arthur Lowe in Dad's Army. You know, he was an actor.
Yeah.
He was a straight actor. Mm. And, you know, comes in and I think that's the birth point that we realise that. And again, it's about what the BBC, how the BBC nurtures talent. We start to realise that the best sitcoms need actors because comedians aren't always the best. I love Hancock. I love Hancock's Half Hour. Love Tony Hancock. He's not a great actor. Like, he's good in context because they're writing for him and about him, and he's basically just being himself. Oh, marvellous, isn't it? And But he's not a great actor. You know, you look at some of the films that he did later, and he's okay, but he can't carry the pathos. As soon as you start putting, you know, Arthur Lowe or Harry H. Corbett into something, it elevates. Wilford Brimley as well, you know, to Bramble, it elevates Bramble. It. And I think that that's something that's carried through a long way. We don't tend to do, or the BBC tends not to do, you know, sort of like stand-up comics, sitcoms very often.
No.
And it shows. It gives you a strength.
Yeah.
To the comedy, I think.
And you know, they use comedians obviously, but it's slightly different. You're right. It's like a balance, and you see that going into the 70s, don't you? You know, you see people who came up with comedy like John Cleese, like Ronnie Barker. You know, they get these great sitcoms like, you know, Fawlty Towers, Porridge, etc. But it does have that balance of what, like you say, these serious actors who then take on these comic roles and are completely transformed by them. And I think the 70s is an interesting one because it's probably pound for pound the golden decade for BBC sitcom, much as there's some great stuff in the 80s and, you know, the 90s, to be fair. But I think the 70s has an incredible amount. But I think what's interesting is that, yes, it's still got a lot of those social aspects to it, but it's less acute than the 60s. It's much more now that you're getting a lot of these reflections, I think, a little bit on empire. You're getting a lot of reflections on war. You're getting a lot of upwardly mobile comic buffoons. People like Basil Fawlty, people like Captain Peacock in Are You Being Served? People like Captain Mannerin in The Dad's Army. Balanced then with, or people like Margot in The Good Life, played by Penelope Keith. You know, these, she's almost like a proto Hyacinth Bucket, you know, in that kind of way. They're these very, in these middle class scenarios, be it a hotel in Torquay or a department store, where it's not people down the boozer or an old man in his chair going, oh, these bloody, you know, it's different. It's much more about people trying to be looking stupid for holding on to these very, either these British traditions or this very stiff upper lip kind of buffoonery that the 70s is taking the piss out of, I think, in a big way. And you see that a lot, I think, on the BBC in that decade. And it makes for some fantastic comedy, really.
Oh, definitely. And I think it's about, it, you know, in comedy, we talk a lot about punching up and punching down and this kind of thing. And I would argue, like, generally speaking, all the best sitcoms, and particularly on the BBC, they tend not to punch down. I think it's not in the BBC's, you know, creative interest to create that kind of comedy anyway. But I think you're right. As we move into the 70s, I think there is more punching. There's more punctuating. Because if you look at the 60s, a lot of it is, it's kind of like, there's a lot of me against the world kind of comedy. You know, the Likely Lads, you know, it's like it's very much kind of like us against the world, you know, looking, commenting on the world. Even Dad's Army to a degree is like us against the world and some of the ridicule almost of the silliness of war. But I think as you get into the 70s, you're right, there's a sort of a younger reflection on the absurdity of authority. I mean, I think we've always, you know, as a culture, we've always kind of like satirized authority and always taken swipes at it. And I'd argue that comedy on the BBC has always done that. But there is a kind of a kind of attacking pomposity.
Yeah.
And it starts to become just a little bit more mainstream. Instead of it just being me against the world, it starts becoming me giving the world a punch on the jaw. And, you know, you look at something like Fawlty Towers, and obviously, you know, that sort of punch on the jaw, it's the person in the middle. It's that kind of like middle class, middle of the road person who kind of like he's trying to drag himself up, but resents the people he's trying to drag himself up to. And I think you start to get a lot of that in the 70s, this kind of reflection. I think some of that is reflected in something like Porridge as well. Sticking two fingers up at authority.
Yeah, and that feels like almost like a blend of the two, because then there is a little bit of that down, you know, that down, Fletchy's like a down to earth, you know, you can imagine him in the boozer having a chat with Alf Garnett, potentially, you know what I mean? It's that all with the Likely Lads. You can imagine that fusion between those kind of people, really. So I think it sort of balances both. So it's interesting.
Where was that crossover? We needed Yeah. I'm going to write a fan fiction radio. We're going to do that.
Where Terry and I can't remember, Bob, I think it is, go to prison for, for a little bit. That'd be great. I'd watch that, actually. That'd be really good. That'd be great. Because it's in the north. It's in Cumberland. So there's every reason why they might end up
maybe
in.
Maybe they're just, or they're just there to visit.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
And then they get locked in the prison because there's a riot. Yeah.
You know, all those things. But no.
Classic. That's
classic, classic. Well, let's take a quick break and queue up an advert for another We Made This Show. When we come back, we'll talk about the 80s onwards and when more of the alternative comedy starts to kick into the BBC and change things a little bit. So we'll be right back very soon. Hey guys, my name is Tony Black, podcaster and author, and I'm here to tell you about Partisan, a podcast about politics and history in film and entertainment. I'll be joined by guests as we discuss films, TV shows, and maybe a little bit more, examining political and historical topics, such as how Elvis intersects with black cultural history.
In Lerman's film, the idea of the black characters are maybe kind of, they're used as catalysts to basically move Elvis forward in his career. I think that's how I saw it.
The rise and fall of Richard Nixon.
It seems to be historians who do agree with this, is that he was the first president that really capitalized on the evangelical vote and politicized them.
The disturbing class satire in society and much, much more. Partisan is free to download on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcast app of choice. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Partisan Pod. I hope you'll vote with your feet and join us on the journey. Welcome back, guys, to You Have Been Watching. We're talking about the BBC and the sitcom landscape across the last 80 to 100 years, and we're sort of going through the decades. So we've just passed the 1970s, pretty much a golden age for BBC sitcoms. So we enter the 80s, and there's still a lot of crossover, like we've talked about here. But this is where you start to get that alternative comedy kick in, really. You start to get a contrast, in a way, between the genteel kind of BBC comedy that's still out there, you know, things like Terry and June that's on, Last of the Summer Wine, which is obviously a big hit, but it's very genteel. Stuff like Open All Hours, you know, which is coming in, which is Ronnie Barker playing much more of a, you know, older character, that kind of thing. But then it's balanced with stuff like, you know, like you say, Blackadder coming in, which does its own thing. Things like The Young Ones, which is a sitcom, but it's a really anarchic version of that sitcom. So I think it's really interesting how, and you get a lot of this punk kind of comedy kick in alongside on the BBC, alongside the shows that aren't old hat necessarily by any means, but are born of a different time. And as the 80s kicks in, which is a very youth focused decade, and we've talked a little bit about this before on the show, but it's a youth focused decade in many ways, you know, with a lot of social change kicking in again, that you start to see that reflected in BBC comedy, I think.
You do. And I think it's almost the most dramatic switch up is kind of like hitting the 80s. Because we've talked about how, you know, the 50s kind of eases into the 60s and the 60s eases into the 70s. And then the 70s is just getting up to the 80s. And then suddenly out of nowhere, it just seems to go and becomes this anarchic, crazy thing. Although, it like you say, there's still this background of you know, Terry and June and, you know, Last of the Summer Wine and everything. But it feels really dramatic. Like, suddenly we've got this crazy, zany, anarchic sort of off the wall, you know, not the 9 o'clock news, sketch show kicks off. And then we get all these kind of sitcoms almost born out of that. And I think it is really dramatic when you look at the change in the landscape, which I don't think has happened since. I think that the 80s evolved slowly into the 90s and the 90s into the 2000s and onwards. You can see that slow progression. But it does feel like at this point, from 79 to 80, there was a sudden kind of like oomph that happened, which I think is incredible. And I think it's really it shows and demonstrates how willing, able and quickly the BBC were able to sort of like adapt to what was happening. And they don't get rid of Last of the Summer Wine because they're appealing to everybody. So they're doing this, the genteel, and they're doing the jolly and the friendly because there's still a huge audience for it. But they're also able to do the Young Ones and Blackadder and all these kind of shows and sort of like push them into success.
No, definitely. Yeah. It's like they respond to there's at this point, there's a broiling anger in UK society, particularly in working class society, about, you know, the effects of austerity and recession in the 70s, and you've got tons of people unemployed, and it starts to kick in, you know, with the start of Thatcherism and that kind of thing, and it starts to kick in with a real punk attitude that then is reflected,
obviously,
in a lot of these shows.
It's really difficult for our audience to understand or to relate to what it was like in the early 80s. That's not something not something that people could connect to today. But trust us, it was shit.
Oh, it was terrible, yeah. Who could ever imagine that in the 2020s, you know, so far? It's bonkers. but this is it. It's there. And then, you've also got the... And it's not necessarily this is less funny, because some of this is great. The safer, more middle-class, middle-of-the-road stuff, like Last of Summer Wine, like To the Manor Born, like Ever Decreasing Circle, stuff like that, some of which is really good. So you've got that. But also... They also managed to have the populist stuff, the real crowd-pleasing stuff that really in the 80s kicks in. Whether it's like old-fashioned nostalgic sitcoms, things like Hello, Hello, which is very end-of-the-seaside pier comedy. A bit Heidi High is a bit like that as well.
Heidi High.
Which I loved growing up. I loved Heidi High. I used to watch that all the time. And it was so much fun. And then obviously the big one, which is Only Fools and Horses, which starts as a... It starts really as a bit of a 70s latent throwback, really. The first couple of seasons of Only Fools are very 70s. They feel like a whole different kind of thing. And then suddenly it becomes a blockbuster hit. It becomes probably, I would say, the BBC's first true blockbuster hit, Only Fools and Horses. And then by the end of the 80s, it's got like hour and a half long episodes that are completely unheard of. It's making... Early 90s, it makes like Miami Twice, which is essentially shot on film, and it's basically a movie. They could have put that in cinemas. I'm surprised. Nowadays, they would have put Miami Twice in the cinemas.
Completely.
So it completely transforms what comedy does in that sense. So it becomes an absolute blockbuster. So it's really interesting how they do all of that at the same time. You've got all through the 80s, the punk aspect, the middle of the road, and then the hugely populist stuff that people watching, they're absolute millions, like tens of millions at its peak. And that's fascinating that they can do all three at the same time.
And it is, again, it's very unique for the BBC because they don't have the same fear, at least especially back then. You know, I think things are more difficult now, but they don't have the same fear of what if nobody likes it. Because I happen to think that the 80s into the 90s was a really strong period for comedy, especially on the BBC, in terms of like new comedy coming up and developing comedy, as well as, like you say, creating these juggernauts of things like Only Fools and Horses. But I happen to think on the commercial channels, it was really bad. It's like there are not really any good 80s sitcoms from ITV. Channel 4 didn't do an awful lot, you know, early on, you know, apart from a few things like Desmond's, which were pretty cool. So I think that the BBC, you're right, almost as a broadcaster, it's a juggernaut of sitcom in the 80s.
Yeah, you're right. Something like Desmond's was more 90s, really, wasn't it? It was more early 90s. And then
I mean, I forget whether it kicked in at the very end of the 80s or the early 90s.
89.
No,
it was, yeah. 89.
89. Okay, so yeah, so... So yeah, not really 80s at all. So
no, but and then you know 90s, the other channels, they do start to get their shit together a bit more. You know, you've got Drop the Dead Donkey
they
and
do,
Channel 4
I think, yeah.
in 1990 and stuff like that. So they do start to get it together a bit more. And I think the 90s is, I mean, that the 90s obviously for you and I probably holds a special place in terms of comedy, because this is the stuff that we were watching as teenagers. This is the kind of things that we grew up with. Stuff like Men Behaving Badly, which obviously starts on ITV and then comes into the BBC, and that's when it becomes good, basically. Once it goes to the BBC, it takes off and actually becomes really good. But it's still doing the same kinds of things, I think. It's still balancing things like Only Fools, which is probably slightly past its peak as you go into the 90s, I would say, really.
Oh,
which is that
I mean...
much as that final...
After Granddad died, let's be honest.
Well, there is an argument for that, yeah. But I think, by the time, even though the final episode of that in the mid-90s is huge and it's watched by tons of people, I think by the end of the 80s into the 90s, it had reached its peak. But you've got things like that that are still popular, and then you've still got the anarchy and the punk, and a little bit of that latent punk aspect in things like Bottom. But Bottom isn't as angry or as, you know, fierce as the Young Ones. It's more of a, you know, pervy. I mean, I love Bottom. I think it's hilarious. But it is more of that pervy, sleazy take on a traditional sitcom, really, with two blokes in a flat, you know?
Yes,
do you know what I mean? So it's got that...
No, it's more structured. It's more, you know, ABC in terms of its plot.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's kind of got... The 90s, I think, has a lot of stuff that we remember as kids that... It's a bit of a concoction because you've got a bit more eccentricity and absurdism and dark humour creeping in now with things like One Foot in the Grave, which we've talked a little bit about before. You've got things like the British Empire, which I'm doing season by season, as people might be listening to, with Matt Latham, which is quite interesting to see that evolve and become even more strange and very Fawlty Towers-y, but full of like surrealism at the same time. And you've got that kind of thing, you know, and then towards the end, you've got I'm Alan Partridge, which completely, it's a strange beast, but it's a sitcom, but it's got that element of Basil Fawlty-esque tragedy to it. But you've got all these things going on. And at the same time, you've got the populism of Only Fools, things like Vicar of Dibley, which is hugely popular and enjoyable for many people. But then the ladette and lad culture, Men Behaving Badly, Game On, absolutely fabulous. Which we will be talking about soon. We've done an episode.
I didn't think it was that good.
it feels like the 90s builds on what the 80s did, really, on the BBC, but then injects more of that 90s, again, like it's done in previous decades, more of the 90s social and cultural effects onto BBC comedy.
Yeah, well, I think what you get is that the 80s, we talk about, you know, alternative comedy, and I keep saying, every time I say that phrase, I say how much I hate it, but we use it. But I think that what happens throughout the 80s, and especially because the BBC is still allowed, you know, under its, you know, the way that it produces stuff, it's still allowed to kind of nurture and grow and develop the more kind of like, you know, Saturday tea time sitcoms. It basically, I think, as a broadcaster, it perfects the recipe in terms of the alternative comedy. So by the end of the 80s, like Blackadder is a completely different show, but is shit hot. It's on it. Yeah. And, you know, we get amazing stuff. And it means the early 90s, you're able to get stuff like Absolutely Fabulous, stuff like Bottom, which you can see the DNA of these early kind of like Not the 9 o'clock Newsy type people, or even comic strip, although it's another channel. You can kind of see that there, but it's kind of been perfected and they've got the best out of it. And you know, I'm sure there are some people that would argue that maybe it got watered down by that point, but I don't think that's the case. And then stuff like One Foot in the Grave, where you've got basically a Saturday tea time sitcom, but it's actually got this incredible darkness and actually strong sense of sort of social morality in there. So I think that the 80s into the 90s, they perfect the recipe. And then in the 90s, we just get this amazing burst of what is almost like perfect 80s comedy, but like perfected. But that's also the point that I think that Channel 4 kind of like pick up their ears and they go, hang on a minute, we couldn't do the stuff you were doing before because that just doesn't work for us, but we can kind of do this. And I think it's the mid to late 90s is where Channel 4 become genuinely start to compete. They start to offer up comparable quality material. And then you get a little bit more of the kind of the talent kind of like switch over between BBC and Channel 4. And poor old ITV, they still just can't make it work. They're still just stuck in the middle.
Yeah, they don't really know what to do, do they? They're still making things like, you know, French Fields and things like that, which I love. Or, you know, After Henry, you know, things that I think if I watched them now, I'd find them much less enjoyable. But I remember watching them as a kid and I liked them. But they're very middle of the road stuff. Whereas the BBC would do in a way middle of the road fare or quite safe stuff, but it would be very sharp stuff like Keeping Up Appearances, which is so funny, even though it's very middle class and it is very tea time comedy, but it's hilarious. But and the scripts are so good.
And it still has a slight edge to it.
Yeah,
there's
it does.
There's a little, just a teeny bit of darkness. Some of the stuff with Daddy and the way that Hyacinth interacts with people. There is a slight darkness there. And I think that, ITV has always been playing catch up. I think they're always, because they have to produce things in different ways. They have to make sure they've got money that someone's going to put adverts in it. So they're always playing catch up in a way that the BBC and, of course, latterly Channel 4 haven't ever had to.
Yeah, exactly.
As broadcasters, both of them can take those chances.
Yeah, totally, totally. And that carries on as the 90s gives way to the noughties. But I think in the 2000s, I think that's where, and I suppose it's that postmodernism that's generally happening, in the wake of the 90s and the social changes that are going on in Britain and to some extent America in the millennium. You've seen a lot of postmodernist stuff in cinema, in music and things like this. And I think it filters into BBC comedy because they start to engage with both the hyper-real and the mockumentary. So you've got things like The Office, obviously, which is a massive... Well, it's a sleeper hit at first, and then it builds into something much bigger.
And like
we talked about in our episode we did on it, I remember being I felt like I was one of the first people to realise this was on. And I remember telling people about it in 2001 going, this is great, like before it became mainstream. But then you've got stuff like, which is a little bit late 90s as well, but you've got things like People Like Us, which we talked about in that episode as being quite underrated. And then later on, you've got The Thick of It, which... is essentially, it's a postmodern Yes Minister, with a much more of a much razor sharp nastiness, but hilarious nastiness to it. And then at the same time, the laughter track starts to go away. So you've got things like The Royal Family or Early Doors, which are resonant of that almost 1960s social, down to earth comedy. But but the laughter track's gone, and it's more character comedy as opposed to social justice or raging against the machine comedy. It's more about people in a situation just ticking along. So you've got that balance, I think, between... It's like the alternative stuff slightly changed. I think the alternative stuff, like you said, is starting to go a bit more to Channel 4 and to maybe some of the satellite channels as well that are now starting to do stuff. Whereas the BBC is now contrasting... almost like the self-parodic, self-referential kind of mockumentary stuff with, if anything, maybe a bit more old-fashioned Safe Affair. My Family, My Hero, Not Going Out, things like that and I know you will have worked on some of this stuff because I think you worked on Miranda, didn't you? And things like that. So you've probably got insider experience that I don't have. We will have, and knowledge. But that's how it feels like the BBC at that point, as the 2000s turns around, that it's sort of trying to self-reflect in a way and reference itself, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that a show like Miranda, it was basically trying to be an old-fashioned sitcom, but it gets a lot of flack, I think, because people maybe don't realize that the show's in on the joke.
It's a bit like
Adam West Batman. There are people who go, oh, it's so goofy. It's always like, it's a spoof. It's meant to be. And I think Miranda is kind of that. And I think that that's something the BBC... The BBC has such a strong history of the kind of the friendly You Have Been Watching kind of sitcom, that they're always trying to have a new one. They're always looking for a new gentle, soft sitcom. And Miranda kind of worked. It kind of hit that mark. But the recipe was just right. It had the right level of, self-knowing, self-reflection. But they also want to produce The Mighty Boosh and The Royal Family. The BBC doesn't want to just produce these safe sitcoms over and over again, but it does want to produce some of them, which is why you get stuff like The Thin Blue Line popping up, which is why you get stuff like The Vicar of Dibley. And I'd argue that the ones that's kind of like are successful and stick always have some edge to them.
I think,
it's like the Vicar of Dibley is maybe a little bit darker or has a little bit more of a social edge to it than you might first think. And Miranda is a little bit more self-referential, a little bit more. I don't know if people can hear this, there's a dog outside who obviously doesn't like Miranda. whilst still producing these kind of, you know, yeah, moving into this kind of this non-studio audience. I mean, there are many factors to why you move to that model as well. One, it allows for a different type of comedy. You know, you can get a different type of performance. It's also a lot cheaper. Studio audience, it's so expensive to shoot with a studio audience. And so I think when somebody comes along and they say, look, we've got this show for you and it doesn't use a studio audience, there's definitely going to be a certain amount of producers and execs that go, oh, okay. But you still need a studio audience show out there. People still want to have one. Unfortunately, I think that's why stuff like Mrs. Brown's Boys have been so successful. It's only because there's a certain audience that have felt almost perhaps starved of their offensive studio audience sitcom.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually, yeah. And that, obviously, I haven't watched a ton of it, if I'm honest, because I just couldn't stomach it, really, what I did watch. But, you know, there's no denying that that's popular. Hugely popular.
Hugely popular,
you know, yeah. As these other stuff that came along in that decade, things like Gavin and Stacey, which again is something I've never really clicked with personally, but he's hugely popular, you know. So, and I'm not saying that's equivalent to Mrs. Brown Boys in the same way, but it's that idea of that it's doing those kind of shows as well as the things that it's done in the past. And I suppose that carries on into the 2010s, doesn't it? Which is obviously the last decade before where we are now as we record, where, I don't know what you think about this, but obviously this is the decade where technology and competing streaming services and all of the things that we're living through now have really crept in and affected the BBC. You know, we no longer live in a world where you broadcast a show on TV. You know, that was what it was like in the 2000s, but that world's gone. People watch things. I never watch channels anymore. I always watch iPlayer if I'm watching the BBC, or I'm watching streaming services. I don't think I ever watch terrestrial television now. And I think under a certain age, I think that's become quite common. So you're in a different world where people respond to comedy in different ways. And now you're seeing comedies that maybe don't last as long, are more contained. I think you've got, you know, things like Fleabag, for instance, which is one of the biggest hits for the BBC this decade, but was only supposed to be one series. It came back and did another one, but they're popular in a different way to what you would have seen before, you know, and sometimes I'm finding now shows that I think would have been absolute BBC mainstays are now happening on other channels. Something like Trying on Apple TV is 100% a BBC sitcom for me, but it's on Apple TV. So it's like it seems like it's diversified in many ways, and I think now you can't. Maybe we're too close to it. So tell me if I'm wrong here, Rob. But it doesn't feel like the 2010s has that definable cluster, beyond one or two examples, that definable cluster of sitcoms and a style in the same way as previous decades have had. But like I said, maybe we're too close to it to know right now.
I mean, I kind of agree. I think that is the case. You're right. I think that we may look back in another 10 years and go, oh, actually, this was kind of the show. But we're also maybe dealing with what I was saying about the 60s into the 70s. Perhaps we're in that sort of flux point because there are shows like Gavin and Stacey, which I guess haven't quite gone away. You know, there might be a few more on the horizon in that kind of Only Fools and Horses kind of way. But I feel like in the 90s, it was very easy to go, yeah, one foot in the grave. That one's, we're going to talk about that 30 years from now. Whereas right now, I don't feel like there's anything, and like you say, there's no discernible style, which I don't think is a bad thing.
No, not necessarily.
I think that things have just plateaued out. You know, the early 2000s gave us that very distinct new style of the kind of the you know, the single camera, the no audience, that became very distinct then. And now I think what we've got is that basically sitcoms come along and they're just made in one of the various styles. Either you do a studio sitcom or you do a single camera sitcom, and then you might have slight difference in the genre of what you're doing. But that's it. Nobody's doing anything new in terms of the style of sitcom, which is, you know, again, it's like whether that's good or bad, or it's because there's nothing new to do, is a whole different debate.
Yeah.
But I think the streaming thing, you're right. It's really interesting because I noticed the last series of Ghosts, which is the sitcom made by the original Horrible Histories team. The last series of that, they put the whole series out on iPlayer.
Yeah.
So the whole thing, boom, dumped it on iPlayer, but then showed it on BBC One Weekly. Because I think that, again, it's this, it's one of the many reasons that I think the whole, people talk about the Netflix model for BBC licensing and all this kind of stuff, and how the BBC is competing against Netflix and these streamers. I think that's slightly erroneous. I think that it's true to a degree. And like you say, you basically watch everything on iPlayer. I'm a little bit of both. I mostly watch things via iPlayer because of its convenience, but there are certain shows that I like to watch them live, for want of a better phrase. And there are certain shows that I quite enjoy the experience of, like, oh, we've got 5 minutes, put the TV on. There is something nice about that. But I think there's still a huge, huge audience out there who watch things linear, terrestrial. They watch it by week.
I do. Yeah. Certainly the older generation as well. But absolutely, that's definitely still there. My mum would never watch anything streaming. She'd never watch iPlayer. It's always terrestrial TV. Yeah.
And I mean, my parents are kind of like 50-50, really. They kind of, it depends what's on, how busy they are. But I think Ghosts is a really good example of a sitcom that actually appeals to both audiences. And this is, again, in terms of what the BBC can do, you might think of the idea of, the BBC are making one sitcom for one audience. You make the Mrs. Brown's Boys for the middle-aged people to watch live, and then you make Gavin and Stacey for people to watch on catch. Well, Gavin and Stacey is old now, but
I know what you mean. Yeah,
something like Ghosts. There's a huge audience who love and enjoy Ghosts, whatever the age or demographic it is, who watch it weekly because that's how they watch TV. But there's also a huge audience who will just sit and watch the whole series in an evening on iPlayer because that's how they watch TV. And I think what's interesting and unique, again, about the BBC is that they can produce a show like that. They're not producing a show specifically for one or the other audience. They're able to produce a show that appeals to both audiences, and therefore they're able to broadcast it in both ways. You can have you have your weekly show, but you can also put it on iPlayer, which no other channel can do. It's like Netflix. If Netflix put episodes out weekly, people get pissy about it. But Channel 4 don't dump a whole series in one go. It's like, it's unusual for them to do that. So I think that in terms of format of sitcom, that maybe is we've hit a sort of a plateau. But I think it is about approach of what they're making and how they present it to us.
Yeah.
Is where we are now. That's what we're really talking about with how the BBC, how they promote and present their sitcoms these days.
Yeah, and it's going to be really interesting to see how that develops. And with a bit of distance, see whether there is that defining sitcom of the 2010s. There probably is, but it might need a bit more distance. I mean, my feeling is that it might be Fleabag, potentially, but I don't know. It's a bit early to say.
It's tricky to say, isn't it? Because again, we're talking about very different. There's only two series of it. Well, I guess Fawlty Towers is only two series of it. Mm. But then is Fleabag more of a comedy drama than a sitcom?
Exactly.
What is sitcom these days? It's like you say, we're too close.
It's a big question. Well, let's
bring back Dad's Army. That's what I say.
Well, you mentioned Dad's Army. Let's finish by rattling through what were there was a poll done in 2003 in which the BBC published a list of what they decided at that point was the top 100 sitcoms. Now this might
take a while, Tony.
I'm not going to do 100. I'm going to do the top 10. I'm going to rattle through the top 10. And I'm just going to rattle through them because we've talked about a lot of them already. And I think the list would probably have one or two more. The 100 certainly would have more on now, 20 years on nearly. But in 2003, this was the list. So I'm going to go from 10 down to 1. So at number 10, One Foot in the Grave. At number 9, The Good Life. At number 8, Open All Hours. At number 7, Porridge. Number 6, Yes Minister. Number 5, Fawlty Towers. Which is quite low for me. Number 4, Dad's Army. Number 3, The Vicar of Dibley. Number 2, Blackadder. And number 1, Only Fools and Horses. And every single one of those is a BBC sitcom. Every single one. Now, that, as far as I can tell, I mean, it was a BBC campaign, but it wasn't asking for what is the best BBC sitcom. what are the 100 BBC sitcoms? This was all sitcoms. And the fact that the top 10 is all BBC sitcoms, most of which were 70s and 80s, or a blend of both, is, I think, very telling. And I think it's a little bit of 60s for one or two, but mostly 70s and 80s. I think that's very telling. I think that probably suggests that the pinnacle so far is that those few decades, in that the end of the 60s through to probably the middle of the 80s is probably where it's at its best, realistically.
And I don't think I would disagree with that. You know, even with that poll being a few years ago, I don't think there's anything really that has come out that would knock those off.
I think
it's a solid top 10.
It is. It would be hard to change a lot. I mean, you could move a few around. You might put a few other things in there. Sure, granted, you know, but it's pretty good, isn't it? And even now, that stands the test of time, that list, I think.
It does. And I think a list like that, that top 10 that you just read out as well, it not just in terms of, you know, the quality or the entertainment value of those specific shows, I think it really is a testament to the cultural impact. And this is what we're talking about, Only Fools and Horses. Only Fools and Horses is almost always going to hit the number one spot on those kind of polls because of the cultural impact of it. Even if it's not your favourite sitcom, if someone says to you, oh, what's the number one sitcom in the UK? You know, from an objective point of view, you're probably going to go, it's probably Only Fools and Horses, isn't it? And I think, like you say, it's very telling that the BBC was the petri dish for all of these different types of... Because that's a very diverse list as well.
Yeah, it is.
Top
10.
Yeah. The sort of the growing ground, the stomping ground for these different type of comedies to grow up, but also to take hold in the cultural consciousness, is something that I think the BBC is just in a unique position to have done and to keep doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it is still doing that to this day. So it's been great to rattle through this with you. I think the impact of the BBC obviously can't be underestimated in terms of comedy. You know, we will return to it so often when we do these episodes. But it's been great to sort of rattle through it and think about the impact that it's had. And here's to another 100 years, basically, I would say. Not that we'll live to see all of it, but we'll hopefully live
yourself.
To see half of it. Well, I'm hoping to see at least half of it, to be honest. I'm hoping to get to the 150th anniversary. That'd be quite nice.
Around for the next Only Fools and Horses special. We'll be here.
Yeah, with that 140-year-old David Jason. Yeah, that'd be...
Lovely jabbly.
And a holographic Buster Merrifield. Yeah. What they need to do is get holograms of Buster Merrifield and Leonard Pierce and have some sort of, you know, almost like a Two Doctors kind of reunion. That's what they should do. But anyway, that's the future. But yeah, it's... It's been great, Rob, to talk about the BBC. And I hope everyone is enjoying what's on offer on the BBC centenary. Cheers. It's been a lot of fun. Until we're back for another episode talking about a specific sitcom. Rob, why don't you cue us up with where they can find you and what else you're up to?
Of course, regular listeners will know that the best place to find me is always on Twitter, where I'm Forducks, which is Forducks. I promote everything I'm doing out there. Well, not everything. I mean, I don't like tweet about the washing up or
taking a
shit or something. But, you know, like pretty much anything creative.
We'll
I'm
do
doing,
an episode I'll on that out there. Next. Yeah, that'll be.
Taking a shit with Robert Turnbull.
Coming soon on We Made This. Yeah,
it's a classic. Yeah. Splish Splash, here we go. But anything I'm doing pod-wise, I usually put out there. And I often crop up on the 616 podcast as well. The podcast 616, as well as Real Talk, if there are any funky films out there. So I'm always around. I'm always around, like Superman.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like the BBC, like, I'm always there.
You'll always be there. Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, fingers crossed.
No, shit.
If we get a Labour government, maybe. Anyway, that's another topic.
God. Please.
Thanks everyone for joining us. You can find me on Twitter at AJ Blackwriter and at my website culturalconversation.co.uk for all my books, podcasts, writing, etc. And find me on We Made This more broadly at we_made_this on Twitter, We Made This on Facebook, and wemadethisnetwork.com for all the different podcasts that are going on. Follow us on You Have Been Watching on Twitter and Facebook, YHB Watching Pod. And give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. 5-star rating review would be fantastic, as I said at the top. So thank you so much. And if you want to support We Made This, please go to our Patreon and throw us a few quid at patreon.com/WeMadeThis, because it really helps keep these podcasts on air. So that'd be brilliant. The BBC and sitcoms over the last 100 years is not all we're discussing. So we'll give you a little taste of what else you might have missed on We Made This in just a moment. But until next time, you've been listening to Tony Black.
And Robert Turnbull.
And we're off to see if we can find some episodes of Pinwright's Progress. Wish us luck.
Do you like pop culture and top 10 lists? If you do, then step inside the Den of 10. In the Den, we have countless top 10 lists to captivate and titillate even the weariest soul. We've got lists of films.
And there's that famous thing about the scene where he improvised his way through smashing his hand and cutting his hand open on the glass as he banged his hand on the table.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't really say boo to that.
Music.
The rest of the song is like just a swirling crescendo of clever songwriting, amazing singing, great drumming, like beautiful guitar effects.
Video games.
And I think that's exactly what happened with Zelda. It was everything looking back. He's on a much lower resolution to what we see in Breath of the Wild, but as I was playing it, I just felt like my imagination was just going absolutely wild.
TV. You know, this is where a sitcom verges on the cinematic, still in a neat 20 minutes. And the interaction between these vastly different characters is so well realised. And more. Listen to us on all major podcast providers. Find us on Twitter at @DenOf10Pod, where you can like, follow, comment and vote, or find us on the We Made This Podcast Network at wemadethisnetwork.com. We hope to see you soon in the Den of 10.